Hi everyone, welcome back to Bookish. My guest this week is the novelist Danzy Senna. I was so excited to sit down and talk to Danzy. We'd met at dinner a few months earlier and I just thought she was so interesting and provocative, and I then went off and read her latest novel, New People, and laughed and winced and marveled at her beautiful, elegant prose. Danzy is a novelist and an essayist. Her first work, Caucasia, was translated into 10 languages and won multiple awards. She's won the Whiting Award. She's written 3 novels, a memoir, and a short story collection, and numerous essays on gender, race, and motherhood. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Vogue, and the New York Times. She's the mother of boys and is also professor of USC. So pretty humbling all round. But on top of that is just a cool, interesting, wonderful woman. And I really loved this juicy conversation that we had. It just felt like exactly what I want this podcast to be able to dive deep into books and talk about other ones, not just the 5 that matter to you, but be able to reference other ones that you've read and ones that occurred to us in the spur of the moment. So I adored this interview. I hope you guys do too. Danzy, thank you so much for doing this. I'm so glad that you have. I'm so glad to have you here and to be sitting in the South Pasadena Library. I was saying that my blood pressure just dropped the minute I walk in here. I think that's my response to libraries in general, actually. Yeah. I don't know about you, but my education was so much time was spent in libraries that I'm like, I just feel peaceful.
Yeah.
I feel like it's dedicated to something that I recognize, and there's a unanimous decision to like not have a phone and not conduct a conversation, and it feels very restorative to me to walk into a library.
Yeah, and this tree outside is like one of my favorite trees.
It's so beautiful. Well, you just told me you finished your last novel.
Room that we're sitting in, this conference room, I finished New People in. That's, and so I thought this would be a good
amazing
place to talk.
I love it.
Yeah, I have a very hard time focusing at home because it's domesticity, you know, and as a woman, like it, you just think of everything you're supposed to be doing. And so I've written many of my books in libraries. Mm. And so I came for the last stretch up and would reserve this room that we're in, this conference room on the second floor, for, because you can only reserve it for an hour. Mm-hmm. And like, I was sort of so sick of working on it, but I knew if I gave myself just that hour every day for the last editing and stuff, this would be safe to just come and focus. Uh-huh.
And so you would do it in an hour at a time?
Well, just
would you
at the end.
And renew it? Okay.
No, I would just do an hour. I always find I have to work in like, just clearly at the scariest parts of my work, I have to only have like an hour or two with the work, or it kind of brings me into a bad place.
Yeah. Is that just in the edit or in the writing?
In the writing, the first draft, I have that, and then at the very last part.
Right.
And then there's a sort of magic middle part when I've written the first draft and I'm filling in and I'm in love with the book, and it's, I can work for hours and hours. And then the end, when I'm anxious and sort of have read it too many times and I don't want to over edit, I do it in limited.
That seems so smart. How did you arrive at knowing that? How did you know that you could only work in an hour at a time? Just brutal experience?
Yeah. And I think knowing it was like giving myself permission that that's how I work, because you read the descriptions of writers of the past, and like they would go in, and it was often men, like they go in from 7 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon, then they fix themselves a drink. And it's like, it didn't fit with my lifestyle, my attention span, my psychological portrait. Like I needed. And so I wrote like my second novel in a cafe in Brooklyn where I had to park my car at a meter for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't leave the book after 2 hours, I would get a really big ticket. Uh-huh. And it allowed me, like the boundary made me feel freer rather than more, you know, oppressed by that.
It's so interesting, isn't it? I wonder whether, a friend of mine says this, that motherhood made her more productive than anything else, just because the confines are so, so huge. You're either paying a nanny, which is, you know, prohibitive, or you're working during a nap, or your kids are at school. And let's be honest, by the time you've cleaned up the house, hit the grocery store and, I don't know, done a sit-up, then it's time to go back again. Like
I know. I would love to hear a bunch of like women writers who are mothers talk about how they manage time.
How they manage time,
because I think the day is over before you've even sat down.
Yeah.
So that friction, and you feel like you're trying to save your own life by writing in a way that I didn't before I had kids. Mm. And that I was trying to kind of protect something that was under threat, like not to suggest anything negative about motherhood.
No, I think that's true and really moving. I think it's really, really true. I think the stakes are so much higher, not just because the time is limited, but one's sense of self is so impinged upon, not to mention refashioned in the presence of children, particularly young children, I find. I don't know, yours are a little older than mine.
But. Yeah, mine are a little bit older, but it doesn't change it. And I wrote my story collection and a memoir and New People. Those were the books. Those are the books I wrote with children. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of more productive in a funny way, but I'm still a slow writer. Like I take a long time to finish things because I have that horrible perfectionist impulse to like
work
something.
Is that true though? I mean, I read, you know, I think I read somewhere New People took 4 years to write.
No, New People didn't take 4 years. The book I wrote before New People
that you put aside, that was
the one that I worked on and worked on and worked on. And then I went out actually in the midst of, and I had a book contract and I felt like, you know, I just couldn't finish this book. And it was under like the pressure of moving a lot, motherhood, children, small children, like the ages of yours. And you know how your attention span gets too.
Yes.
I mean, you can't finish a sentence or a thought. It's always being interrupted. And I had this book that was just like this battered object that I was carrying from home to home with kids, babies. And it was like the depressive object of my life because I could not finish it. And I couldn't even get a sense of what, you know, like I kept abandoning plot lines and sort of couldn't, it was aborted feeling. Yeah. And I was just sort of feeling like I was going to have to go into the witness protection program because I owed my publisher money. And I went out with my friend, Juno Diaz, actually. And he had worked under with the same publisher under a contract and like nearly kind of lost his mind and took forever. And he was sort of, we were talking about how you have to feel free again when you have sort of some reputation as a writer and you've published and become defined in a certain way. And he was saying like, he had just reread my first book and was saying that like, there's so much like anger and craziness in that book that nobody ever talks about, and like how I should just let myself go to the crazy. Mm. And I remember thinking like I had this thread of a beginning of something really crazy, and I just sort of allowed myself to secretly write that and didn't think it was going to sort of be published even. Mm-hmm. I just was writing it to try to remember what it was to like have pleasure writing.
Mm, lovely. Yeah.
And to amuse myself alone and just make myself laugh and sort of the sort of dirty pleasure of that book. Mm-hmm. And then it was finished in 6 months. And I called my publisher and said, like, I have good news and bad news. The book you bought is in a drawer and unfinished. And then I said, like, I have this other book that I want to share with you.
So then I would argue you're not a slow writer.
Well, yeah, maybe I can be.
Maybe you
I've decided now that I don't ever want to spend that long. I want to write all my books in a blast because wouldn't that be nice? I just feel like you're aware at a certain age that you don't have that much time and your brain is not going to always be as alive as it is. I liked what happened with this book, which was that the momentum, I didn't pause to question my decisions. Mm-hmm. I just let the momentum of the story kind of pull me to the end. Mm-hmm. And then I just, you know, filled in and stuff. But there was a kind of, I wrote it sort of to be read in one sitting. Mm. And in the spirit of that, like wrote it really...
I get that. I read it in two, so
two sitting.
Mission accomplished.
But like kind of getting into that propulsive
thing. Are you a fast reader?
Now I'm, if I read in the morning, I am. If I read at night now, it's, mm-hmm. I fall asleep.
Yeah.
So I've really become more of a daytime reader, mm-hmm. which is really luxurious.
Isn't it? It feels
the best.
Decadent. It feels like it does. To me, it feels as decadent as like deciding to watch a movie when
or a martini
sun's out
at noon.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And yet, so necessary increasingly. Yeah. I think we talked about this when you and I met at dinner that time. I feel like more and more in this world that we're in this political climate, in this, you know, insidious world of social media, that to step out of the rat race, to lie down on one's bed and pick up a novel, particularly a novel, seems to me the most radical political act you could do in this
moment.
That's
so interesting you say that, because that was something I was thinking a lot about, because everybody's so outraged on Twitter all the time and sort of throwing out these thoughts about things that, of course, you know, are sort of obvious and everybody agrees with you. And I was been thinking like my resistance to Trump is to go deep mm-hmm. and to read something and sustain my brain mm-hmm. and my thoughts, mm-hmm. like protection against sort of Twitterdom and all of that. And I feel like the novel has become this really necessary protection for our brains and our souls.
I feel that. Yeah. I totally feel that. My New Year's resolution was to get off Twitter and Instagram, so I deleted them both from my phone. And I have felt almost immediately restored concentration and really restored, despite what I said earlier about being anxious, a restored sense of self-esteem that I did not know was being eroded by it.
Yeah.
But more importantly, I feel inoculated against.
That's such a good word for it. Yeah.
By immersing more in books. I've read, first of February today, I've read 10 novels this year already. Now that's five more than I'd read last year, no question. It literally doubled. And it's not because I have so much more time, it's that I have so much more willingness to immerse. And I think the Twitter, Instagram thing makes one so breathless and so ready for the quick fix. Whereas
it reshapes your brain.
Yeah.
I mean, what your brain needs.
The novel prolongs.
I think it
does. It asks you to stretch out and elongate and suspend your judgment until you've reached 300 pages in or whatever. So I
love that. That's exactly how I'm feeling. What sort of keeps me from reading as much as I want to is that I've started teaching.
Right.
And so I'm reading in preparation to teach.
At USC, right?
Yeah. I'm on the faculty there now. And it's a really different way of... Last year I had the whole year off and I read for pleasure. And I was, you know, really missing that this year because I was reading sort of just to edify and discuss. And it was a different... And I kind of love the thing of just... I don't know, just kind of that. I love when I'm so involved in a book that I am irritated, like, by the sight of my family.
Yes, isn't it the best?
And you're like, can you just let me finish this chapter?
Seriously, no, I agree.
Just been great when that happens. But it seems like this year has been off to a less... I'm jealous that you've been reading.
It's January.
Like
no,
I'm impressed.
How easy was it to come up with the books? Were there ones that were immediate, the five? Were there ones that you had to reach for them?
I'm trying to remember the five
the
now.
Five
you have to show me.
We have The Easter Parade by Richard Yates. We have Quicksand by Nella Larson. We have The Talented Mr. Ripley by Patricia Highsmith. Giovanni's Room, James Baldwin. And A Handful of Dust, Evelyn Waugh.
Yeah, so those are like, those are sort of desert island books.
Yep.
So it wasn't hard to think of them. And
which one chronologically, Matt, which is the one that you started with or that felt formative at its earliest stage?
Giovanni's Room I read in high school.
Uh-huh.
And
who gave it to you?
My mother gave me all my books.
Really?
And would just, you know, I went to subpar public schools, and she's a poet, my mother, and sort of my first teacher in many ways about how to be a woman and a writer. She's a very, you know, serious writer, and I was a single mother with three kids, and my like earliest memories of, you know, writing is her on the Olivetti, like typing in a room and screaming at us to shut up. And I really cherish those memories now that I have children.
Yeah, I bet.
And she wrote as if she was trying to save her own life and did, you know, and I think gave me that. And she would give me books, both my sister and I and my brother. We were just surrounded by books. And she gave me, well, I read The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison when I was 10.
Wow.
I mean, she, like, there wasn't sort of that feeling of dumbing it down for children. And we were expected to, like, engage with these really big ideas. And Giovanni's Room was, like, you know, about a, written by James Baldwin. He was just so ahead of his time and was about, you know, a white American in Europe passing as straight. I mean, like, nobody's doing that now. Like, we're supposed to write in our lane, stay in our lane.
Sure.
And James Baldwin was so liberated and sort of passionate as a writer. And it's such a short novel. I love short novels. They're my favorites, where it's like 200 pages or less. And it just is like a sort of unsparing look at sort of the cost of shame and concealment. And but I loved it in high school and loved him as a writer. So
and I did not know the book, to my shame. So I was
that's reading. Your next book.
It is my next book.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny that you say that because I just finished The Bluest Eye, which I never read before. Again, astonishingly, and I realize, you know, it's sort of high school standard fare, or at least obligatory, mandatory.
I'm wondering if it is because it's got all that incest in it.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't believe we were passing it around my fifth grade. Like, that's really...
Yeah.
Because I
don't know. When I've brought it up to people here, they've gone like, oh, yeah, I haven't read that since high school.
Oh, okay.
A few people have referenced it. Having been brought up in whitest England, you know, there was no reference to any African-American literature whatsoever. African literature, nothing. My entire education was straight white men, basically. So... unsurprisingly, I hadn't heard of Giovanni's Room, and I was so fascinated by it. Obviously, I know James Baldwin, but I didn't know that he'd written an entire novel about white people.
There
was not a black person.
Isn't that amazing?
In it, yeah.
And it's a really, and it's like, I don't remember if it's 180 pages. It's really short and just beautiful.
And you know, from what I read, you know, published in 1956, pretty ahead of its time, as you say, and.
Yeah.
About a man who goes to France because his fiance has gone away and goes and has an affair with a guy in a bar, Giovanni.
Giovanni, yeah.
And then the girlfriend comes back and he tries to make that work, and it's but it clearly isn't, and she calls him out on it from what I was reading about the novel. And I was really struck by this idea of passing as straight, and also... so the passing as straight was one thing I was struck by. The other thing was the American in Europe, which I think is such a...
the trope.
Yeah, totally. And I'm really interested by it. Henry James is a favorite of mine, and listeners of this podcast know, because I had my producer interview me for season one. So I picked my five books and went on at length about Portrait of a Lady, which so I won't do it again now. But that this idea of these innocent Americans in old... Europe, I think, is a really persuasive one, and yet also could do with some picking apart now. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It feels a little outdated, maybe, in the global world that we live in, and yet entirely right for a 1956 novel.
I do think that's true. I mean, I lived in Europe.
You said you
a
were
few
in
years
France,
ago,
yeah.
And was very aware of how much that dynamic had changed. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think for him as a black American, Europe had a whole other meaning. Mm-hmm. Like, people really did go into exile. Mm-hmm. A lot of the Harlem Renaissance writers went there to be free.
He wrote this
free.
In France, right?
Yeah.
I think he wrote it.
He finished it in Turkey, in Istanbul, actually.
Wow.
But in, you know, he was living in France for a really long time, and it's dedicated. My sister's name is Lucian, and it's dedicated to someone I think was his lover Lucian.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
But he, there has been a greater sort of acceptance of the sort of wide range of Black voices, American voices in France. It's like famously a place for exile and freedom. But when I was living there 4 years ago, I was aware that it was no longer that.
Really? Were you in Paris?
Yeah. And it was kind of, it felt very dusty and sort of like it hadn't evolved as a city and that they were not aware of their own racism in a really profound way.
Sure.
And there was, like, England actually felt like light years ahead of France.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like, to their detriment, they had marginalized every other culture because it was keeping them from having, like, you know, that idea of hybrid vigor that England had.
Sure.
And, like, they were kind of dying in the shadow of the Louvre or something.
Yeah. No, I agree.
With like the Louvre and McDonald's and between the two.
Not much else. I agree. I think I feel that way about Paris. I love it and I long for it and I long to take my kids there. And I'm so deeply grateful I'm not living there or raising my children there. I think it is living in a museum and living with monuments to things we don't necessarily want to memorialize anymore. So I'm not sure.
I think it can be saved by, you know, the people in the outskirts.
Yeah.
I think that if they allow for that to infiltrate and don't, you know, keep their culture so under glass, that it could be saved in the way that I think England has been, like, the lifeblood of England is all those immigrant cultures.
Totally. I mean, I think architecture has a lot to do with this. I mean, London literally is a higgledy-piggledy Charles Dickens cottage next to a 1970s high-rise full of Pakistani immigrants. I mean, there is something about the architecture of London that lends itself. This is not to say that there isn't hideous ghettoizing.
No, but
there.
I mean, obviously there.
But
yeah,
it does feel more, however awkwardly, integrated.
Yeah,
in Paris and the banlieue.
For sure.
Suburbs and stuff.
I mean, I lived in England for a year too, and I've spent a lot of time there because my sister moved there 25 years ago and I visit her often. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's like a totally different experience in terms of, especially for someone who thinks about race and identity, like, I couldn't believe the sort of level of the conversation in France.
Really?
I was shocked.
In what
way? I mean, like the headscarf ban. It was like, are you, the sort of feminist intellectuals explaining to me why that was necessary. That's shocking to me.
Wow, fascinating.
That was their level of feminism.
Right.
Still too.
I'm struck by, I'm sure you've read about or heard about this book that in France is called Chanson Douce, and in England, I think, is called Lullaby, by a woman called Leila Slimani.
Probably I have heard of her. Yeah.
But I think I'm right in saying she's North African, possibly Algerian, and I have to check that. But she's written this novel that just won the Prix Goncourt, and I read it. It was one of the novels I read this January. Because I was fascinated by the furore, and it felt maybe like it was going to be a little more slight than the kind of literary fiction I'm usually drawn to, but at the same time, it's winning all these prizes, so I figured, why not? And it's about a woman who is North African who has a white nanny, and it is about
I've got to read this.
And the first line is, the baby is dead. So it's pretty... I haven't given anything away because that's the first line. So you go from there.
Oh my God, I've got to read it.
It's interesting. It's interesting. It's provocative. It doesn't actually go anywhere that I think is profound or revelatory in any way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I feel like it at least initiates an interesting point of view, an interesting conversation. I've listened to her interviewed, and New Yorker did a profile on her. She's a very interesting woman, and I mean, I hate to say this, but actually more articulate in person than the book is. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, she's good at talking about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. It's why I despise going to movies and going to the Q&A afterwards. I feel like I know that director will seduce me into believing I saw a great movie and I fucking didn't. Like, put it on the screen.
Yeah,
you don't get to tell me about it afterwards. And I slightly feel that way about this book because, you know, she's been offered the position of Minister of Culture in France based on this one novel. I think she published one more prior to it. And it's really in their hunger to anoint somebody of color
Well, at least they're at that stage.
Exactly.
That's good.
I agree, and I defer to it and think, hallelujah, great, yeah. Better this than the alternative. But wow, how nascent is this movement there that it takes one book about the hierarchy being inverted and really not much else happens for her to become, you know, literally minister of culture. She's turned the appointment down because she says, I don't want to have to toe the line and I want to be able to get drunk at cocktail parties. And
no, good for her.
Not watch my,
I like that she
much
did
language.
That.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But
I mean, it's funny. You said it's a short novel too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I mean, The Stranger I could have put on here too.
Right.
You know, and Marguerite Duras. Like, I think the French really perfected a certain kind of existential novel.
Yeah. What's the next one on the list that matters? That matters not, they all matter, but that chronologically, or which is the next one?
Yeah, well, I would say Quicksand by Nella Larsen. I read both of her two novels in college.
Passing is the other one.
Passing and Quicksand, mm-hmm. and they've just reprinted Passing, but they really need to do one of Quicksand. And
maybe you need to write
I wrote the introduction to Quicksand in France.
Oh, did
and
you?
And the French, they republished it in France, or published it for the first time in France.
Oh, really?
And I wrote the introduction because that's the one of the two novels that doesn't get as much attention.
Interesting, yeah.
And it is so brilliant.
Mm. Tell me why. Why did it matter to you?
Well, I had, you know, grown up biracial, sort of appearing to look white to the world and having, you know, a very sort of strong sense of my Black identity. And her characters are so modern in the way that they grapple with race. And there are two novels about biracial and mixed race women.
Because she was biracial. She was Danish and
Danish
African American.
Right.
Yeah.
And Caribbean American, but grew up here. And they were just so radical to me in the way that I saw myself as part of a long tradition. For one thing, I saw myself in a kind of context, and everything I had struggled with identity-wise was there in her books, mm-hmm. even though I was reading them in the 90s mm-hmm. and she was writing them in the 20s.
Yeah.
And they were like, and in a way that's sad that it was the same struggle, but in a way it was sort of strangely comforting. Okay. And I would say she was the greatest like literary influence on me.
Really?
She's unapologetically, her female characters are unapologetically screwed up.
Uh-huh.
And they are non-redemptive novels. Uh-huh. They're like, they go against everything you're supposed to write as a woman.
Uh-huh.
And they're, nothing is sacred. Everyone is safe for like tearing apart uh-huh. and turning over sort of these real sacred ideas of community and female bonding. They're just really ahead of even our time in uh-huh. some ways. Uh-huh. And she only wrote two novels and had a very sad, difficult life. And so I just cherish that book in particular.
Uh-huh.
And it's got the most amazing ending of I don't know if I would be giving it away to say.
Share it.
But it's like this character has ended up trying to find a home. She's mm-hmm. homeless, you know, her whole life racially mm-hmm. in all sorts of sense. And she's keep looking for a racial and kind of tribal home.
Mm-hmm.
And she ends up in the worst possible situation of marrying this repulsive minister in the South, and she's this very intellectual, worldly woman, and she, in her desperation to find a home, she goes and marries him and starts having babies and goes into this kind of fog of motherhood, and it's the most horrifying description of motherhood.
Oh, wow.
I love being a mother, but this is like goes to the dark side.
Yeah, but the best people do. Rachel Cusk is a favorite for
me
this
too.
Reason.
Yeah, yeah, me
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
And The you see her like having baby upon baby and then coming out of the fog of it and realizing with horror what she's done and planning her escape. And like the last few lines are like the horror of realizing she's pregnant again.
No.
And it's like it just ends.
No.
With her like
pregnant again.
Yes. And it's like a horror movie ending, but about like the entrapped sense of women and like five babies or something. She prepares to have her fifth baby, and you just realize like she's extinguished herself.
Yeah.
And it's just an incredibly just uncompromising book.
Yeah.
And I can't believe she wrote it when she wrote it. that she dared to write that.
It's reminding me, for maybe just thematically, of that amazing Kate Chopin book, The Awakening.
That is such a good, yes, which is, I love that novel.
Which is that yeah. same thing at the end where she just walks into the ocean. That's her only out of yeah. this marriage, this right. hideous situation that she's found herself yeah. in. This, and it's the same, you know, it's this, again, sort of heartbreaking Emma Bovary trope of yes. women that the only, that their only exit is that, it's just self-extinguishing, be it by having the fifth baby or walking into the ocean or taking arsenic or whatever it is. It's like...
Exactly. That's right. That is a really good parallel yeah. book text. I mean, that would be a great class on like books right. about motherhood, right?
Motherhood and what it yeah. fucking does to you.
I mean, I think Rachel Cusk would have to be a part of that. She, yeah, she's really
amazing. Isn't she wonderful?
That's actually funny you mention her, because she's someone I've been reading a lot of lately. And I don't know when her third part of that trilogy is coming
out. I only read the last one.
Transit.
Is that the, yeah.
I read the Outline and Transit.
No, Outline is Greece. Okay, yeah. So I need Transit
in England,
next.
And
okay.
It's amazing.
Oh, great.
She's such a funny writer. Like, I found her books hilarious in this very kind of quiet way.
Yeah.
And
I just like how she just stays in the blood. I haven't got a better word for it than that. Yeah. But like, she will stay with the most uncomfortable, unerring truth about her experience, her, you know, fictionalized experience, but will write the most unappealing fucking side of herself, the bit about motherhood that you just don't want to own, or
exactly
the bit about divorce,
marriage,
or freedom,
yeah.
or any of that. And I love her for that.
Yeah, and you know that, like, when someone writes like that, they've paid some kind of
yes,
cost,
right?
And they've earned whatever they're doing.
Yes.
Like, that's what I dislike, is when you feel that someone has not earned.
Yeah.
That you know they're sort of skating on the surface,
right,
and she really feels like she goes deep. I mean, she reminds me a little bit of Lydia Davis.
Have you read Lydia Davis?
But who I love, but I felt like Who's Rachel there? Cusk. Lydia Davis is famous for her short stories,
yeah.
or like a paragraph.
Mm.
And she's just so playful and amazing, and you'll love her.
Yeah.
But I did feel like there was the same absurdist quality to the Rachel Cusk, but it went really dark and deep.
Right.
So I was really excited
yeah.
when I read her.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to write down Transit, In Transit? No, just Transit.
Well, that's the second Rachel Cusk
book. Yeah, that's
book.
The
yeah.
one I need to
And I know there's a third with that trilogy that is going to come out at some point,
yeah.
but I don't
well,
know.
Well, I'll catch up with number two. This book I saw on your list, and it just made my heart swell. The Easter Parade.
Oh, my God.
Because on my, when I did this, Revolutionary Road is one of my five.
I couldn't decide between the two. Of those. That scene in Revolutionary Road at the play at the beginning. And
Petrified Forest, just the worst, isn't it?
The other book I would say is a really good book, and I can't remember the title, is the biography of Richard Yates.
Oh.
That was probably the last book that made me cry.
Oh, is it?
If I was going to say,
yes.
you know, on your list.
Which one is
it? It's
that
called
Young
like
Hearts
a,
crying
not a Brutal Honesty or something like, I can't remember the title of the biography of Richard Yates, but it is so
it
good.
Do you know what was fun was when I was reading about this, I put the Easter Parade back by the bed because I realized I haven't read it.
Oh,
I've
my
read
God.
Everything
oh,
else
wow.
by him. I
right.
own it. And it's part of the wallpaper, if you like, of my bookcase.
Yeah.
You know, where you just, your eye
yeah.
skates across it. And so when I saw it on your list, I ran to pull it out and was like, oh, fun. Let me just see what Danzy's. And I got six pages in and was like, I've never read this. I bought this and I never read it. So thank
Great.
You because it's by the bed.
Oh my God, you're going to love it.
I know I'm going to love it.
I think we have the same taste.
I think so.
I'm feeling
yeah. kindred. You know what was fun reading this? And I share this as a you know, wannabe writer too, is that Yeats at his most successful never sold more than 12,000 copies in hardback.
I love that.
Isn't that?
Well, I was just asked on a panel I just did, like, do you check your Goodreads or Amazon ratings? And I never,
yeah.
ever look at those.
Oh, good.
And I thought, like, I'm not writing for committee, and I'm not writing to be a bestseller, because the best books I've read were not bestsellers.
We never were,
like,
right?
So I'm not writing to sell to the widest,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
group of Americans. Like, that's not my goal in life. Yeah. And you know, some of the writers I love the most, their least successful books were the ones I liked the most. And the Easter Parade, like, people didn't get that book.
No, not at all.
At all.
Well, although it was his comeback, from what I've read, after he
from his one of his many nervous breakdowns.
Yes, exactly.
Alcoholic.
And he surprised everyone with producing it, and it came, you know, he sort of handed it. It sounds not dissimilar to your showing up with new people in your hand going, hi, good news.
Oh, yeah,
I gather he knocked this out in a year and sort of blew everyone away with it. Yeah.
I must know that from the biography, but it was... I love both of those books of his.
When did you come to it? How did you come to it? Who brought you here?
I think it was... My husband gave it to me.
Had you read Yeats before?
I had read him, a lot of him, and I loved him. And I had read Revolutionary Road and several of his short stories. And I think, yeah, my husband said this is his best book. Mm. And I hadn't heard of it or read it. Uh-huh. So I read it maybe 10 years ago. Uh-huh. And it was just that, it was also, I tend to like that sort of non-redemptive story. But I had spent 10 years in New York really kind of single, and I had hit some really dark places in those years, mm-hmm. and sort of without a home, mm-hmm. I was really trying to figure out where I belonged in sort of domestic life and romantic life. And I mean, he, like, this man wrote about that female experience with such care and poignancy, and it just, and then the two sisters in it are the sort of never really recover from their parents' divorce. Mm-hmm. And that, like, I feel in my family that we've, all three siblings have literally spent these decades, like, nobody has really recovered from our parents' divorce.
How old were you when they divorced?
They started the separation, I think, when I was like 5. Mm-hmm. And, they divorced when I was about 8,
right.
But it was a cataclysmic, mm-hmm. you know, war.
Yeah.
And the reverberations, he just describes the reverberations of it on these two women and how it affects them differently. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't sort of stop. It keeps pushing the pain meter until you're done with the book, and it's not relented, and it's really... I don't know. I just felt that brutal kind of honesty of his.
I agree. I think it's what I felt too. And it was also, particularly in Revolutionary Road, but in Liars in Love and, you know, any of his work, really. The brutalness of domesticity is so wonderful. Mm-hmm. This coexistence of who you think your best self could be, your idealized version that... You know, you might be slumming it as a copywriter, but in your head, you're really writing those novels, or you know, and then slammed up against the just tawdriness of getting kids fed and paying bills and, you know, a car breaking down
and the dreams that you kind of crush.
These sort of
that are crushed by, for the men
dreams.
And the women.
Yes, exactly. And there's no... Interestingly, for a man that was writing in the 50s and that was writing completely sort of madmen stuff, there doesn't seem to be a patriarchy at play there. It's just, there's just these sensibilities that dare to hope over and over about who they might be. Mm. And I know, isn't it like a cry talking about it? Because you do read it going, well, so what are you telling me, Richard Yates? Should I not have the hope? Should I just be in the domestic?
And I love that he won't tell you.
And he won't tell you.
Because he doesn't know come either. Down. And, I mean, the book about his life has the most poignant story in it about how, you know, he basically would go on a alcoholic bender from, like, late morning until he passed out. But he had, like, these 2 productive hours that he would work.
Wow.
From 8 to 10 in the morning or something. Then he'd begin the drinking. And he just, you know, really lived on the edge in a way. That was, like, I used to go to Breadloaf Writers Conference. I still go sometimes. And, you know, there's famous stories about his going into, like, DTs and stuff. But he... toward the end of his life, he was living in sort of a crappy apartment complex, and it was filthy, and his life was, he was in terrible health. And when he died, the only thing that was pristine that they found was his new manuscript in the freezer.
No.
And it was so poignant to me that, like, that was the one thing he
kept pristine,
kept safe in his life was, like, the art. Yeah. And he just protected that till the very end. Like, that old thing where you put your manuscript in the freezer in case there's a...
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And so it was just so... His life was really moving to me, even though he was probably a monster and... certain people's lives. He was a brilliant artist.
I feel like that's so part of the conversation at the moment is, do you get to be a monster and do we get to revere your art? You know,
we would have to erase a lot of great artists to be,
wouldn't we?
Pure.
I agree. Yeah. I feel like
I'm not down
with these you know, out of the fae bonfires we're lighting at the moment.
I'm not either.
I'm really not down.
I find it very frightening.
Yeah.
Very frightening. And social media being a huge part of it.
Right. Which is why I have to say absenting myself from it has felt like one of the greatest acts of self-care I've pulled off in a long time.
Exactly what you mean. Exactly. I was like realizing my health as a writer has been, and my ability to write has been about filtering and like not reading all the reviews, not taking, like one of the great things about living in LA too is that you don't get the sort of peripheral writerly gossip constantly.
Right. Interesting.
If you're a novelist,
right.
If you're a screenwriter, you probably do. But I think
not if you live in Malibu, it's perfect. If you live where I live on the top of a cliff, you can switch it all off. I tell you.
Check. Yeah, and so I sort of like have filtered out so much even before sort of social media became so much a part of our cluttering. And every time I would publish a book, it was like, I knew that my goal now was to protect the next book and protect my freedom of thought and that I could imagine. And so taking in all that stuff feels like really dangerous to my imagination, actually.
Right. Counter to creativity altogether, I would think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your next book, The Talented Mr. Ripley, I'm going there next. You don't have to. We have that and Handful of Dust. So whichever one you want to talk about next.
Oh, I just, I'm rereading The Talented Mr. Ripley right now.
Oh, you are?
But I, because I decided to teach it to my students, actually.
Fun.
In a class on passing. So I'm not teaching just racial passing. I was teaching con artists and grifters and... also sort of straight, passing a straight.
Yeah.
And
Patricia Highsmith, just sounds great.
It's really been fun. But Patricia Highsmith to me is another one of, like Nella Larsen, one of those like just artists who's born free and original and who is just not in their own lane, like, you know, James Baldwin. Mm-hmm. And I love thrillers. Mm-hmm. I love books that have that same quality as a great thriller. Mm-hmm. And that book is so taut and crazy. And she goes so deep into this sort of sociopath point of view.
Yeah.
And I just think it's an amazing work. I love her writing in general.
When did you come to her? Do you remember?
Patricia Highsmith must have been... in my 20s, I think. I don't think I read her in college, and she was kind of a revelation.
Had you seen the movie before you read the book?
Oh, yeah. I read the book first. No, I read the book first.
You'd read the book
because it was before the movie. And
No. Published in 1955.
No, I mean, I know I read it before even that movie was made, before Matt Damon was a whisper on my lips.
I'm so interested by it because I'd read Ripley and had loved it and was so struck by this really seminal difference between them, which is that the movie makes this a story about loneliness. In a way, that was my interpretation.
The book or the movie?
The movie felt that there was something, you know, whatever, Matt Damon, whoever, whatever that performance is. But I felt like the book is about a sociopath.
Yeah.
There is,
I think you're right.
This is not
a, and that's what's daring about it.
Yes, that it's not so a desire to fit in.
Yeah.
That it is actually...
or class aspiration.
There's something glassy and impermeable and not as permeable to sort of facile psycho. What am I trying to say? You don't get to just go, oh, poor lonely guy, desperate to fit in. The movie to me renders him, perhaps rightly for us to care about it, but much more sympathetic. We to a degree, we are like him on the outside watching glorious Gwyneth Paltrow and Leggy Jude Law dance.
Right.
And we, like him, want a part of that. We right. hunger for it too.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And I remember reading the book and feeling like, no, that is not, because I saw the movie first and then going to wanting to see what the book
right.
was and feeling like, no, this is not. What she's doing is, as you say, braver than that. She is not offering an apology.
And she's had a huge influence on me because I had a second novel that was horribly panned after my first book. I wrote this book, Symptomatic,
right.
and it was very influenced in a way by her.
Oh, really?
And kind of wanting to write this, like, sick horror humor book.
Uh-huh.
And it was like... But I was writing about race uh-huh. in a kind of horror movie trope. Like, uh-huh. it was a thriller about race, which now, you know, there's Get Out. And, like, uh-huh. there is that genre uh-huh. now. But I was kind of writing where I wanted to write about, like, sort of female mixed race sociopaths.
Uh-huh.
And now I've gone back to that with new people. And, like, I feel like it's a return to my roots. But it's really, like, Patricia Highsmith is a huge influence on me.
I was going to say, because I, by the way, loved New People.
Oh,
as I say, devoured
you.
It in two readings. I just couldn't get enough of it. It's so, it's so deft and it's so funny and in its darkest way. And yet... You don't lose anything. The joke isn't at the expense of anything ever. I feel like it's so earned always, the humor. It's what makes really good satire. But I just loved it. I really, really loved
you.
It. But when I saw Patricia Highsmith, I was thinking, how is this in Danzy's work? And I was wondering whether the amorality of that character, of having a lead who kind of doesn't give a fuck, who will try anything
great, yeah.
once, be it Scientology or being a nanny for an afternoon
right.
or falling in love with a poet who doesn't even have a fucking name, far less a body of work from what
right.
I can tell. Like, I sort of loved the, you know, it could be conceived of as sort of bumbling from one thing to the next, except that Maria's far too focused and driven to sort of bumble into anything. But there is something sociopathic about the being so inured to what the societal norms would dictate about
yeah.
showing up on time for your bride's, you know, for your wedding dress fitting.
Right.
Or not shaking somebody's baby that you
right.
don't even know the fucking name of, you know. Like, these felt like... Anyway, whatever.
Yeah, I love that way of describing it. And I think it was written in that spirit of, like, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
And I'm going to write that book where it's, like, going to that part of
yeah.
me that isn't going to, like, kind of kowtow to the sort of the next literary book I'm supposed
right.
to write, the next mixed race heroine, mm-hmm.
yeah.
this and that. And I felt like I really needed to write my way to freedom mm-hmm. as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, she, you know, these people we've been talking about are kind of my beacon
yeah.
light, where I think I have to channel this spirit
right.
of this person who wrote so much from a spirit of freedom and just kind of rebelliousness.
Right.
And I, you know, and I've had readings from new people where the audience members have said, like, I really didn't like Maria
mm.
and I really liked the book. Mm. And I love that. Like, I'm
right.
like, thank God that we
Job
still
done.
Have an audience that cannot like the
can
female protagonist
mm-hmm.
and can handle it
mm-hmm.
and still find, like, they don't need to identify.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need to be, as you've said about Patricia Highsmith, like, we don't need to sympathize.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to be interested
mm-hmm.
in her.
Yeah.
And, like, so I wanted to do that. And I think, you know, Highsmith is just so daring, and that book, these are all people I feel have written, like, way past our moment in
yes,
some sense.
That's
you
so
know?
Interesting. That's so interesting. I think that's totally true. Do you think that of A Handful of Dust, Evelyn Waugh?
That's for sure in that same category.
It belongs, right?
Oh my God.
Too.
I mean, I just reread it because I remembered it having such a huge impact on me.
When did you first read it?
I think it was another one of those books that my mother gave me maybe in college, or
mm-hmm.
I didn't read it for a class. And my grandmother is Anglo-Irish
wow.
and a sort of really, she was a real sharp satirist. Mm-hmm. She wrote three novels. Mm-hmm. She published three novels in Ireland. She worked with Yeats. She was a, wow. you know, a poet. I mean, not a poet, but an actor who started this thing called the Poets Theatre. And she was this amazing figure who I knew very well growing up. And we would visit her in Dublin. And mm-hmm. she was sort of part of that world of Evelyn Waugh in a way. Wow. And she was the girlfriend of someone who was a writer in uh-huh. England, Anthony Powell. And she...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And she so I have this very strange, like, girlfriend? Literary family.
Incredible.
And yeah, there's more to her. She was wild.
Is she in Dance to the Music of Time? Is she in one of those?
No, but... There's more to say about okay. my grandmother. All she's right. she's been written into some biographies of some big men because she was very wild. Uh-huh. And but she was very satirical, that sort of bitchy British humor that's just
favorite.
Scathing. I love it. And that book, you know, A Handful of Dust, like he kills the child. I mean, he... And then that's like and a third says, of the way in.
And she says, thank God.
Yes.
That it wasn't my lover.
I know. It's incredible.
It's amazing, yeah.
And he just, then the ending of that book with the guy trapped in the Amazon being read Dickens like for the rest of his life by this crazy man.
Isn't it crazy? The
what
ending?
A crazy book.
So just for listeners who haven't read it, it's this I'll praise it horribly, but I think he's called Last, Henry Last, I think is his
yes,
name. Yes,
it's a great name.
A great
yeah.
name. And he has this completely, you know, benighted marriage and a young boy, and he's the last to know that his wife's having an affair, and his wife is having an affair with a man called John, and his son happens to be called John. I think he's called John Henry.
A little sweet little boy.
Sweet little boy who, as you say, a third of the way through dies in a riding accident, I think, and he has to tell
his wife. He's horribly neglected.
Too. Yes, so he's ignored.
Nobody cares
ignored
about
by
this
the author and the audience and the parent, but ignored
it's
by
like
everybody.
It's like such a send up of the British upper
class. The British upper class
the
and
coldness.
The way they were raised.
Yeah.
Exactly. And he has to tell his wife, and she said, and he says, John is dead. And she says, and he she nearly faints, I think. She thinks he means
her lover. Yeah.
And then he says, I mean, John Henry. And she, in spite of herself, says, thank God. And it's an amazing moment in I think.
In literature.
In literature.
Yeah.
That he lets that happen.
He lets that happen.
Anyway, the marriage falls apart and he goes off to the Amazon, Henry Last, and ends up in the hands of this nutter in the Amazon who only wants to be read Dickens. And then a rescue mission is sent to find Henry, and the nutter manages to sedate or put Henry in a coma or something.
I'm laughing
and
hearing
hands him and hands back, I think, Henry's books or his glasses.
So they all are going to think he's dead.
So they
now.
All go back to England, this search party with proof that Henry Last is dead, and he's stuck in the Amazon reading Dickens for the rest of his life. I mean, I bastardized that horribly, but
no, that was brilliant.
That's
that
like
was
the
great.
Rough sketch of it, and it was. I mean, I'm with you. I think it's devastating and daring and biting and sort of an eye-opener. I mean, it's a real... It was also written in 1934, which
yeah.
is...
Yeah, I mean, I must have some soft spot for that era because of the
right?
writers
yeah.
I like seem to...
They're
but,
all somewhere.
Yeah, well, the Nella Larsen and someone else on this is Giovanni's Room's later.
That's
but,
56. Yeah,
but I have been weirdly watching a lot of movies from the 30s too, and I'm just fascinated by that time creatively.
Yeah.
But I mean, you must have read Waugh and England.
I have. Well, I went to Christchurch, Oxford, and so Brideshead Revisited, you know, half of which is set there. So I had the extraordinary experience of listening to Brideshead Revisited as read by Jeremy Irons,
oh
and I
God.
Listened to it at Christchurch, so in my rooms, which were in college in the huge Tom Quad, in the
wow.
amazing courtyard that I lived in for a year, and listen to it, and then would walk out and go and, you know, cross the quad and go and get dinner in the crazy halls. And
right.
it was a very, very strange, very meta experience. Truthfully, as I, the older part of me looks back and thinks, I loved Brideshead, and I loved it for deeply sentimental reasons. It's a very sentimental.
Yes, it's totally different
totally
from
different.
The Handful of Dust,
and
I loved it too.
Yeah.
But it had less of that craziness
yes,
of the
it's
other
less,
book.
It's less acidic. It's fatter. It feels like
yeah,
it's
and a little gentler and more
yes.
sort of poignancy in
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly.
The other one, it just never
no,
lets up on the satire.
I
mean,
know.
It's crazy.
I was reminded of that. There's a brilliant Oscar Wilde quote that is, "One must have a heart of stone to read the death of Little Nell without laughing. And I just was like,
oh my God, he's the best. He is so fucking good.
And I was like, yes, exactly. Those are words that Evelyn Waugh just lived by.
I think they're both, you know, that's the spirit of Oscar Wilde, you know.
Yeah,
that.
Right? It's both. There's all the tragedy, and we have to be able to, like.
And the funniest things are always sort of hinge on tragedy.
Yeah, that's, yes, exactly. I have some
such
follow-up.
A failure on this list.
No. I'm gonna throw in like five questions at you from the.
Okay,
these were not meant to be.
Because I didn't. I was driving.
You are not to worry. These are like follow-up questions to throw at you if you feel like it. I'm gonna pick a few at random. What's the book or author you feel most guilty about not having read?
I've never read Gravity's Rainbow, uh-huh. And I've never read Infinite Jest.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I feel guilty, but I feel that. There are many people I love and respect for whom those books are seminal, and I've started them both.
Yeah, but we've established your love of the short novel. They're never going to happen.
Yeah, those two did not make the cut. And I remember, like, yeah, just I'd have to pretend at a dinner party that I'd read them, but I'm never going to. Yeah. But I have read shorter pieces of both of theirs. And
I'm with you.
Loved, you know, certain short stories and the shortest of the Pynchon novels.
The shortest of the Pynchon.
The Crying of Locke.
I've never done Pynchon, so you're
I'm ahead of you. Okay,
completely.
Well, I haven't read those two.
Is there a book that you expected to like but didn't?
I think the Ishiguro book Never Let Me Go.
Oh, Never Let Me Go. Interesting.
I just didn't. Mm-hmm. I was bored.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I actually loved one of his novels that everyone hated called The Unconsoled.
Oh, I loved it.
I loved that book.
I loved it.
And it got
sort of reviews. Yeah.
And for me, Never Let Me Go, I just couldn't, I don't know what it was. It might have been timing. So much of reading is timing, but it wasn't.
Didn't do it for me.
Yeah.
I think I liked it. What is the book that you know, this is the question, what's the book that gets you laid? What's the book that makes you look good when you recommend it, that you know makes you look
that
really interesting?
Really interesting. Oh my God. That's a funny question. I remember getting hit on the subway in New York when I was reading Paul Auster.
Oh, really? Which one?
By like a hipster dude.
I was reading
The Invention of Solitude, which is my favorite of his.
Yeah.
And it's a short memoir, and it's his only memoir, and I think it's brilliant. But I remember I actually was hit on, but under the bright glare of the New York City subways.
I would say if you can get hit on under that light, you are streets ahead.
Now, not so much. But I was like 27. A lot of subcutaneous fat in my face.
God, we all need that. Last question. What is a book that almost made the list but didn't? What was a close contender? Well, you said maybe L'Étranger or The Stranger.
Yeah, The Stranger. And also a book that I just recently taught. And I never say his name right because I'm not Afrikaner, but Coetzee, Disgrace.
Coetzee. Yes.
I love that book.
It's wonderful.
And it's just one of the most perfect books in terms of just the structure and the voice and how he tells that story in so many pages, you know, in such a short amount of pages was stunning.
I loved it too. And then I read the one after it and I did not love it as much.
Yeah, I haven't loved any of his books as much as that. Mm. But I do like that all the sort of imperfection that when you look at a writer who's done it really sort of perfectly
and then
looking at the books that weren't so perfect around them is sort of comforting as a writer.
I agree. It's so true.
Because you see
what they're aiming for. Yeah.
And they're working through some idea and then it crystallizes.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it'll crystallize again. But like, I think some of the other books, you can see him working through it still.
So true. It's such a lovely and forgiving way of looking at work too, is to look at the body rather than the individual of it.
Yeah.
I lied. One last question is, you can only take one book to your desert island. Which is it? Can be one of these five or it can be another one.
Oh my God. I always have a hard time with that. Like, and with people. Like which person would I bring?
God, oh, I would never bring a person. Are you kidding?
I don't know if I could bring, you know, I would say like sentimental value. One of the writers I loved so much when I was 13 was Colette.
Oh,
and I read all of her books from about 13 to 15.
Oh,
and maybe I would bring Colette because it would remind me of like my youth.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know if I'd even like her now, but I would just hug it under
just
the
have it.
Coconut tree.
Use it for shade, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Okay. Danzy Senna, thank you so much.
Thank
this
you.
Was such a pleasure.
This was thank great. You. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's interview. If you like the show, please write us a review on iTunes, on the website. It really makes a difference. Rate us, give us some stars, let your friends know, let your family know, tell everyone you can. Go to the website, bookishwithsonyawalger.com, if you want to find out about any of the books that you heard about. We list there not only the five favorites, but every single book that is referenced. You can also buy the books through the website, and we make a tiny, tiny little percentage of whatever you buy through the website. So if you are interested, please go ahead and click on that. You can find us on Facebook. We have a Bookish with Sonia Walger page. You can find us on Twitter with @BookishSonia or @SoniaWalger.com. And you could also email me through the info@BookishWithSoniaWalger.com page. If you hit on contact, it'll just automatically pop up as an email there. So if you have any ideas for guests that you'd like to hear from, or thoughts that you have about the show, please don't hesitate to share them there. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the show.